Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. And welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week, I'll be talking with Whitney Stewart about her book Feldpost, The War Letters of Reiner Niemann. We'll also hear from Raymond Boudreau, who's the guest coordinator of ContraFlow 6, and I'll review Colson Whitehead's new book, The Underground Railroad. Whitney Stewart's writing life has taken her many places. She's been to Myanmar to write about Aung San Suu Kyi. She's been to Nepal for her biography of Sir Edmund Hillary. And her most recent book became a deeply personal search as well. Today we'll be talking about Feldpost, The War Letters of Friedrich Reiner Niemann, a German soldier on the Eastern Front. Whitney discovered these letters, and then they were translated and edited by Dennis Hovell, and she wrote the afterword to this book. Whitney, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Nice to see you, Susan.
Now, the arc of the story, finding these letters, it's just amazing, and then bringing them to the world. So tell us about how they got from World War II to post-Katrina New Orleans and now to this book.
I don't actually know how they came to America. I presume these letters, Reiner's letters, were saved by my mother-in-law, Lieselotte Anderson, and she shipped them to America. After Hurricane Katrina, we saved whatever we could from her flooded house, and there were some neglected boxes in the attic. Those boxes were put in a storage unit that later flooded.
Oh, no.
In 2011, and my husband, Hans Anderson, brought those boxes to our back shed. In January of 2012, I was putting away the Christmas tree stand in our shed and found these boxes and looked at them and screamed out loud because it said in German, Reiner's War Letters.
Wow. Wow. So did you know enough German to make sense of them at all?
So we had lived in Germany for 2 years, in Göttingen, Germany, when our son was small. And so I learned German, not beautifully, but I learned German when we were living there. And I've always been interested in German. I've also always been interested in Reiner. I first heard about him when I read my mother-in-law's unpublished memoir. And she wrote about her brother who went missing. And that's all it said. And I saw one photograph of him, and I was so obsessed with knowing what happened to him 24 years ago that when I became pregnant in 1991, I said to Hans, let's name our son after Reiner. That was 20 years before I found Reiner's letters. And all that time, I wanted to know what had happened to him.
Wow. That's just amazing. So how did Dennis Hovell enter the picture?
So that's an interesting story. I went to a Kindling Words writer's workshop, and I met a woman whose brother could read German, an old German script. And I posted on Facebook, does anybody know anyone who can help me translate these letters? I don't read old German Suterland script. And Reiner's letters were so philosophical. His language is so erudite that I also couldn't understand even the letters that were typed because they were just above my level in German. And this friend of mine from Kindling Words wrote me on Facebook and said, well, my brother might be interested. And I would love to pay tribute to him if I could. I asked him before this interview, could I ask you why you did this?
Yes.
And he gave me a beautiful answer. He said, when asked if I would translate the considerable number of letters of a German soldier, a young man who had disappeared without a trace near the end of the war, I did not hesitate to accept the task. Though a complete stranger to me, he was, after all, a lost uncle, a lost brother, a lost son. One does not often have the opportunity to provide such a service to a family seeking closure of a sort. However, I was not long into this task before both the task and I were transformed. As I was turning German words into English words, Reiner was no more a distant stranger in a distant world. I was now in his world, and he was writing directly to me. And he was alive again, still young, still hopeful, still so vibrant, and now, through his letters, he always will be.
And that's what is really so marvelous about this book. So tell us a little bit about how you personally connect to Reiner. I mean, he really does come alive in these letters. And you said that his life, this story, touches on all your feelings about history and ancestry and war and human rights violations as well.
So I've always written on human rights violations.
Right.
And this is a story of a sensitive, artistic, musical young man, like my son, by the way, who, unlike my son, was drafted into the German Wehrmacht against his will. This was a very strongly anti-Nazi family. Drafted at age 19 into the Wehrmacht, sent to the Russian front four times, and then disappeared. And no one knew what happened to him. He wrote his parents letters several times a week, sometimes every day, because that's how dedicated he was to them. And no one knew what happened to him. And my mother-in-law wrote to the German government until 1991. Her last letter was in January of 1991, the year, by the way, that my son was born. And she never found out what happened to him. And they kept promising to let her know, and they never did. There's something in that for a deranged madman, Hitler, to take away the lives of so many people. And they had no say in it. This touches me deeply.
And they had struggled for so long. He was wounded twice,
right.
You know, and so they knew about that.
They knew
about
that.
To have him disappear, I can't even imagine. One of the things that you love about him as a reader that comes through so strongly in these letters is what a dutiful son he was. He was concerned about his family. He remembered all their birthdays. He went home whenever he could. He doesn't write much about politics at all. And he's also not a terrible complainer. He looks for the good in things. So I wonder if you'd read a bit from this one letter that I found particularly lovely.
Yes, I will. Dear parents, this is October 10th, 1944. I'm deeply impressed and filled with pride that every member of our family, scattered though we may be throughout Europe, has managed to be brave, high-spirited, and clear-headed enough to see what needed to be done and has done it. Though we are all facing different situations, we know not one of us will despair, break down, or act in some foolish way. From you, Mother, we have inherited your always positive outlook, which seems to grow stronger the more dire the circumstance, and has allowed us to regain our balance in the face of fear and worry, and do that of which we did not think ourselves capable. I could send a hymn of praise to you, but from Father we inherited the basic rule, let deeds speak for themselves. That is Father, always clear thinking, considering all factors but not allowing himself to be diverted from his path, always doing what is necessary in the interest of us all. I could speak boundlessly in your praise, but words have now become hollow and empty. But one must remember their meaning and the spirit in which they are used, the love and the humanity. As I am far away from you, words are all I have to use. And he wrote that letter the day that his brother was killed in Italy, and he didn't know it.
So this family lost
two sons
during the war. So tell us about that trip you made to look for his grave.
So I made three trips, actually. The second one was in January of 2013, and I chose January specifically because he was lost in January. He wrote his last two letters home on January 12th, 1945. So I wanted to experience the cold that he may have experienced in Poland. And I had written to the German government, and I have discovered that Reiner was actually buried in a graveyard in Poland. But when I reread the letter, I saw that it said he was reburied in this military cemetery in Poland, and they never told the family. So I said, where was he originally buried? So they finally drew me a map, and they sent it to me over the internet. And I took this map and I found this tiny village of Grabowa in Poland. And my translator and photographer and I, Pavel, we went to this forest. And we walked along the edge of the forest. And I was very nervous for some reason. I just felt the war. I felt I was trespassing on somebody's land, trespassing on history. But I was determined to find where Rainer ended up. And as we were walking through the forest, I got very nervous. And I said to Pavel, if we were walking in America and trespassing on someone's land, someone might come after you with a shotgun. And he jokingly said, ah, they just use an axe in Poland.
That wouldn't be very reassuring to me, Whitney. No.
And sure enough, maybe 20 minutes later, along came a man. And I looked up and he was wearing a shotgun draped over his shoulder.
But you persevered.
And it just so happened that his friends who were with him knew where the German bodies had been dug up in 1997. And they took us right to the place where Rainer had been found in a mass grave.
And they were glad to help you.
They were glad to help us.
So that's an amazing thing. Mm-hmm. And you ordered a stone for his grave.
I did. Rainer had no personal headstone. And so I felt that was very important. And my mother-in-law was still alive. She lived to 97. And I was able to tell her what most likely happened to her brother in the last of his days. And she was really happy to know that we had had a headstone made for him.
That's really a very wonderful thing that you did. So tell us what your inscription was, what you chose.
We actually could not write an inscription. We could only write his birth date and death date. But if I had written one, I would have taken one of his quotes, which was my favorite. And he said, "In each of us is the other preserved."
That's lovely. And that says so much about who he was as a person. And now you're working on a version of the story for younger readers.
Yes, I am. I attempted to write this as nonfiction for younger readers, but I think it's a difficult subject, taking the perspective of a German soldier for an American audience. I still think it's very important because I would like young people to recognize that this one German soldier, in fact, didn't have a choice but was forced to fight for Hitler against his will. And when I speak in schools, students are really drawn to that subject. When I ask them, have you ever been forced to do something that goes deeply against your sense of self and who you think you are, the deepest sense of you? And the students raise their hand and ask me lots of questions about that very subject, about what do you mean Rainer was forced to do something against his will? You know, and we talk about that. And that becomes a powerful question, a powerful topic for discussion about war and about human rights.
And an enduring topic. We still have young men at war. They are still writing letters like this, you know, and these letters are still treasured by families and kept for generations. And hopefully they'll be found by someone like you eventually in the future. We've been talking with Whitney Stewart about her latest book project, Feldpost, The War Letters of Friedrich Rainer Niemann, a German soldier on the Eastern Front. You can meet her Tuesday, September 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Whitney, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Auf den Nesten in den Gräben ist es nun still und ohne Leben. Und das Atmen fällt mir, ach, so schwer. Die Vögel singen nicht mehr.
Raymond Boudreau is the guest coordinator and part of the team that develops panels, presentations, and events for Contraflow, that fun gathering of science fiction and fantasy writers and fans that is celebrating its 6th year this fall. It's grown steadily over the years, and the event takes place September 30th through October 2nd at the New Orleans Airport Hilton in Kenner. Raymond Boudreau, welcome to The Reading Life.
Hi, thank you. Thank you.
Now, I know there are cons, as these conventions are known, all over the country. But how did this particular one, how did Contraflow get started?
Well, Contraflow got started in 2006 after Hurricane Katrina. the previous long-running convention in New Orleans called Crescent City Con had actually coincidentally stopped in August. And a number of us were realizing that we needed to bring something back to New Orleans. So we got together and decided to put on the kind of science fiction convention we wanted to go to. And soon, ContraFlow was born.
And now it's up to 6 years. So how many people are you anticipating will be here?
Well, last year we had just over 600 people, but we were also the Deep South Con Regional Convention then, so I'm sure we've got a number of people from the outside the region who might not have otherwise come to our convention, but I would expect upwards of 600 people.
Now, I counted more than 30 authors who will be on hand, and that's not counting the other guests who are comic artists or entertainers or editors. You have a whole range of people coming.
Yes, we do. We're a general science fiction convention. We're centered towards literature and reading, but we have gaming, we have shows and music. We have a hospitality suite where people can relax and get a snack. We have a lot of different things going on at ContraFlow.
And your guest of honor this year is Ben Bova, who's the great science fiction writer. Tell us why you chose him.
Well, Ben Bova has been a fixture in science fiction for many, many years. Not only is he a known author, but he was also the editor of Omni magazine in the late 70s through 1980s. He co-wrote a book with one of our recurring guests, Les Johnson, called Rescue Mode, about a journey to Mars, about the things which happen when a voyage to Mars occurs. And it's a hard science fiction book, meaning that the science and engineering are correct. They pay a lot of attention to details. So we thought he would be a good fit with some of our other guests of honor we've had in the past. So we asked, and he thankfully accepted.
It's so interesting to me that some of these science fiction writers come directly out of that hard science background. They're trained academics in a lot of ways, and then they get channeled into government projects as a result of their science fiction writing, partly. It's an interesting combination of blurred lines, you know what I mean?
It is interesting, and one of the most famous science fiction authors of all time, Isaac Asimov, was a PhD. He's also a science popularizer. For a lot of people, science fiction is how they get into science. There are probably as many scientists as aren't who originally became interested in science through science fiction. So I think that never leaves them. They always have that bug.
Now, in addition to science, art is kind of an important component of this event as well, because you have guest artists who come and display their work.
Yes, we do. This year, our artist guest of honor is a man named Richard Hescox, who does beautiful work. He not only does work for covers for science fiction novels, but he does a number of illustrations. He's done illustrations for movies and for gaming. He did an entire series of work, for example, for George R. R. Martin's Game of Thrones. He will be having a presentation on that, showing his illustrations for Game of Thrones.
Wow. And people are encouraged to come dressed as characters or their own creation. That's an important part of this, isn't it?
Sure. Costuming and what's now called cosplay is a big part of ContraFlow. We have a costume contest on Saturday, but there are plenty of people who just come in costume all throughout the convention. You know, someone asks me every once in a while, in fact, someone will ask me, why do people do that? Why do they dress up in costumes at science fiction conventions? And I always say, you know, why do they dress up as costumes in Mardi Gras? It's
right.
Fun.
Was that a New Orleanian asking you that question?
Yes.
I'm surprised. So what's the best costume you've ever seen at this thing?
Oh, gosh, it's hard to say. We have had some outstanding costumes, many of them from anime and movies. It's really hard for me to pick just one. You know, people will post their photographs on the website. Well, they post it on the Facebook page mostly. And you can see some of the various costumes over the years that people have worn.
So tell me, what is it that keeps you working on this project? Because you've worked on it a long time, and it's a lot of work. It's like having a second job to put something like this together. What is it that sustained you in this effort?
Yeah, a job I'm not paid for at all.
Right.
It's the pleasure of seeing people come to the convention and sharing the thing that I love. it's a service to me when I see people and they say, wow, Raymond, I had a great time. That panel was awesome. I get great satisfaction out of that. You know, my first science fiction convention was in 1978, a convention called Vulcan, which was held in various places around the city. And when somebody says, ContraFlow was my first convention, that makes me feel good.
Oh, yeah, because you know, you really know what that means, you know?
Exactly.
And one of the other things that ContraFlow does that I so admire is that you always raise funds for a charity.
That's correct.
And that's a very special part of what you do. So tell us about that.
Well, our charity is the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library. We have a lot of involvement with the library. The librarians put on panels and programming at our convention, and we always have an auction, a charity auction on Saturday for 3 hours, where all of the proceeds go to the Friends of the New Orleans Public Library, which helps the library with programs and all sorts of areas of the operation.
Oh, that's fantastic. So what are you personally most looking forward to this weekend?
Sleep? No.
No, you sleep when it's over.
That's right. I have to tell you, the one thing that, and it's weird, that I like the most, that is the one thing that I like doing at ContraFlow, is on midnight on Friday, we do a showing of a really, really bad movie. It's called Friday Night Schlock at Midnight. I picked the movie, and hopefully it's something a lot of people haven't seen. I mean, a lot of bad movies get recycled because they're wonderfully bad. But Alfred Richard of the New Orleans Worst Film Festival, and he's a kind of fixture on television.
Oh, yes.
And so forth. He's a great version of the Mystery Science Theater 3000 robots. He's great at riffing on a film. And what I do is try to pick one that he hasn't seen. And so he will encounter the movie for the first time and riff on it while it's playing. I always love doing that.
Oh, the power.
Yeah.
Oh, well, I hope you have a blast, and I hope lots of people come out. We've been talking with Raymond Boudreau, who is the guest coordinator for ContraFlow, the science fiction and fantasy convention coming up for the sixth time, September 30th through October 2nd at the New Orleans Airport Hilton in Kenner. For more information, check out ContraFlowSciFi.org or check out the Facebook page. Raymond, thank you so much for all you do.
Oh, thank you, Susan. I appreciate it.
The best historical novels take us to a place we think we know and return us to our present reality, changed in some way, perhaps more knowledgeable, more compassionate, more thoughtful. That is certainly what happens with the startling new novel by Colson Whitehead, The Underground Railroad. What, he asks us, if the Underground Railroad were an actual railway system with trains and tunnels and hidden stations? Would we have the courage to descend to the depths of a deserted platform, rush headlong into the darkness, not knowing what lay ahead? Maybe freedom, maybe a dead end. Desire is often the emotion that propels great fiction, and what is stronger than the desire for liberty? That is what propels Cora, the daughter of a runaway slave, to escape from a Georgia plantation with her companion Caesar and Lovey, heading away from the abusive Randall brothers. Caesar and Cora end up in North Carolina, where they find jobs and work in a community that seems to accept them, within their rules, of course. Cora ends up working in the Museum of Natural Wonders, where she reenacts plantation life and African origins to the amazement of visitors and at a profound cost to herself. Her journey continues along the railroad to South Carolina, where she witnesses lynchings in the park across the street from the house where she is hiding. And then the slave hunter Ridgway captures her, and her journey takes yet another turn, and on it goes. Cora is driven not only by the desire for freedom, but for knowledge as well. She learns to read, she works hard over biblical texts, enough to challenge notions of slavery with verse citations, and she loves above all the almanac, with its notes of changing seasons. If heaven is a library for Borges, so it is for Cora. One of the most heartbreaking lines Whitehead comes up with is this one. She was never the first person to open a book. Whitehead chronicles the indignities and insults of slavery in painful detail, the lack of control over one's own body, the enduring scars, physical ones, as well as the cost of hope and pride and ambition. But still, stubborn human assertion will have its way, luckily, and by novel's end, we will see eloquence and inspiration and a possible future. When Cora first boards the train, a station agent tells her, "If you want to see what this nation is all about, you have to ride the rails. Look outside as you speed through and you'll find the true face of America." Though this later comes to seem a cruel joke to Cora, looking out of the darkness, it is nevertheless the great achievement of Whitehead's novel. Ride these rails, look outside, and you'll never forget the view. This was America.
Wade in the water.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Today's guest, Whitney Stewart, discusses in Signs Feldpost, The War Letters of Friedrich Rainer Niemann, Tuesday, September 27th at 6 at Octavia Books. Jim Smith Jr. discusses in Signs his book, The No Excuse Guide to Success, No Matter What Your Boss or Life Throws at You, Tuesday, September 27th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. The writers of Esoterotica, Zach Moore, Shadow Angelina, Ruby Shears, and Mike Marina are the featured readers at the Blood Jet Poetry Series, Wednesday, September 28th at 8 at BJ's in the Bywater. Harvey J. Lewis discusses in Signs A Legacy Preserved, Contemporary Louisiana Duck Decoy Carvers, Thursday, September 29th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Contraflow 6, that gathering of science fiction and fantasy fans, takes place September 30th through October 2nd at the New Orleans Airport Hilton in Kenner. This is the con's 6th year, and the featured guest is longtime science fiction writer and editor Ben Bova. For more information, go to contraflowscifi.org or visit the Facebook page. Poets Daryl Bork and Julie Kane read at the Poetry Buffet at Ladder Library, Saturday, October 1st from 2 to 3:30. Michael Alenzell reads from In Signs the new novel in his Bobby Delery series, Law and Desire, Tuesday, October 4th at 6 at Garden District Bookshop. Christopher Romaguerra reads from his work as well. Peyton Burgess, author of The Fry Pans Aren't Sufficing, is the featured reader in the 1718 reading series, Tuesday, October 4th at 7 at the Columns Hotel. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening and keep reading.